Thank you all for coming. I hope we're going to have some fun tonight. This is a flaky kind of book, a strange kind of book, a fun kind of book. This is a dialogue book, like many of my books. It's an imaginary conversation between three people. One of them is a philosopher, and one of them is a scientist, and one of them is a poet and a surfer. And these three characters, which are, of course, concretizations and incarnations of three forces, philosophy and poetry and science in the world, and three powers of a human soul, they're taken from my forthcoming novel, which will be out any day now. I usually take about 6 months to write a book. The novel took 20 years. It had to grow like a plant. It's called An Ocean Full of Angels. It's about spiritual warfare. But so far I've gotten four more books of dialogues from these characters, so probably more will be forthcoming. The point of the book, or rather the takeoff point of the book, the reason I wrote the book, was that I noticed a very unusual article in the paper in 2007. It was a story about a scientist in California who may have come up with the holy grail of physics, called the unified field theory, which Einstein himself sought for all of his life and never quite found. And ever since his death, scientists have been searching for it, and there's no credible claim to have found it yet, until Garrett Lisi, 39, who had a doctorate in physics but no university affiliation, came up with this. And it centers on the most elegant and intricate shape known to mathematicians, called E8, which is a complex eight-dimensional mathematical pattern which, if written out in tiny print, would cover an area the size of Manhattan. He is a surfer. He spends most of his time surfing in Hawaii. Is that accidental? I don't think so. I think if Einstein had been a surfer, he might have actually found the theory of everything. This is highly speculative. I am not a scientist myself, I'm just an amateur. I don't even teach the philosophy of science. But a whole host of ideas in the philosophy of science came together to make this book, and I'd like to share just some of them with you and hope that you can intuit how they all belong together. First of all, what would a theory of everything cover? Well, it would be about energy, because that's what everything in the universe is. Matter is just frozen energy. And all forms of energy come in waves. And the way to understand a wave most intimately is to get inside of one. And that's what a surfer does. A theory of everything would also unify the two levels of physical reality, namely the ordinary space-time continuum, where energy comes in waves, and the quantum level, where energy comes in particles. So a theory of everything would unify those two levels, as well as unifying the four fundamental forces of the universe, namely gravity, electromagnetic energy, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force. I think it would also unify physical energy and mental energy. We use the same word for both. We don't use the same word matter for both the spiritual world and the physical world. We contrast the spiritual with the material. But energy unites the two. I suspect that the quantum level in physics is something like the subconscious level in thought or in psychology. It works by very different rules. It escapes the laws of the ordinary level, and yet it conditions the ordinary level. We know a few of the ways, ever since Freud, actually ever since Plato, Book 9 of the Republic, is a kind of a Freudian psychology of the unconscious, 2,000 years before Freud. But we know in the last century quite a few of the ways in which the unconscious influences the conscious, but we don't know how it works. We don't know how the two interface. And there's also no theory in physics that unifies the quantum level and the ordinary space-time continuum level in physics. And there's no good theory in philosophy, ever, that successfully unifies the two realms of matter and mind, or matter and spirit. We know that they exist by immediate experience. There are some people that deny one or the other, and some of them are very clever. Buddhists, New Agers, and some Hindus deny the existence of matter. They say it's just a projection of mind. Materialists deny the existence of mind. They say everything is matter. But most people believe that there is both mind and matter, because we are both mind and matter, and we immediately experience both. And yet, we don't understand how they're one. You are one person. You use the word I, not the word we, unless you're using the royal we. But you're one person, and yet you're both visible and invisible. It's your mind, and it's your body. What is that you? The mind thinks, and it doesn't take up space. It's not made of molecules. It doesn't have extension. It doesn't have mass or weight. It doesn't have kinetic energy. It doesn't have color. But it can think. Your body, on the other hand, has all those other features, but it doesn't think. So they're two clear and distinct ideas, and yet they're one. You're not a ghost plus a machine. Your body's not a haunted house. That's a mystery no philosopher has ever solved. Why not? Because most philosophers, like most scientists, use a kind of thinking that's very valuable and very powerful and very effective, but it's not big enough, it's not broad enough. A theory of everything has to be found by a kind of thinking that's an everything thinking. A theory that unifies all of objective reality must be reached by a union of all different mental powers, a kind of whole brain thinking. Actually, this is, I am told, passé now in cybernetics or brain science. The left hemisphere and the right hemisphere don't really work separately. But what used to be called right hemisphere thinking or right brain thinking is basically intuitive thinking. And left brain thinking is analytical, rational thinking. And both science and philosophy specialize in left brain thinking. But poetry, music, surfing, intuition, this is all right brain stuff. Well, you're going to have the whole brain working in order to understand the whole universe. But most attempts at finding the unified field theory are strictly left brain stuff. So we have to bring in a surfer and a poet, which is what I do. That isn't the kind of thing most scientists or even most philosophers pay much attention to or respect. The success of careful, analytical, logical, scientific, calculating thinking is spectacular. Ever since Socrates, logic is the best tool for doing philosophy. And ever since Galileo and Kepler and Bacon, the scientific method is the best method for thinking about the material universe. So because of the success of these left brain enterprises, we've neglected the whole right brain and classified it as something for women, you know, women's intuition. It's politically incorrect to even use sexist terms anymore, but insofar as we do, there's always an implied inferiority on the part of the intuitive and superiority on the part of the rational. If you compare our way of thinking with that of almost any ancient culture, you'll find that we are vastly superior in this one kind of thinking and vastly inferior in all the other ones. Maybe we can learn something from our ancestors. So this book is a plea for a kind of, I like to call it the Hamlet principle. One of my favorite quotations is from Act 1, Scene 1 in Hamlet, where Hamlet sees his father's ghost on the castle parapet and tells his friend Horatio about it and invites him to come and see the ghost too. And Horatio doesn't believe in ghosts. And then Horatio too sees the ghost, and he is totally flummoxed. Doesn't fit into his worldview. He doesn't know what to do with it. And Hamlet says to Horatio, Horatio, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamed of in your philosophy. Well, that's my philosophy. Moreness. There's only three possibilities. There's either more things, fewer things, or the same number of things in heaven and earth, that is, in objective reality, than are dreamed of in my philosophy, that is, that are in my mind. So either the world is richer, poorer, or exactly the same quantity as what I think. The philosophy of all great thinkers and all great artists of all time has always been the Hamlet philosophy. On the cover of my novel is a picture of a tiny little boy on the shore of an enormous sea, looking very small at something that's very large. That's the philosophy of a very little child. But as Newton said, when I look at my achievements, and Newton was generally regarded as the most brilliant man in the history of the world in his own time, I find myself to be nothing more than a little child playing in the waves at the beach. That's one philosophy. It seems to me that that's the richest one and the most profound one and the most productive one. An opposite philosophy is that there are fewer things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of in our philosophy, so that most of our thoughts are fantasies and myths and have to be refuted, and that the right attitude towards the world is doubt and suspicion and cutting it down to size. A third philosophy, held only by arrogant people, is that there are exactly the same number of things in heaven and earth as in my philosophy. In other words, I know it all. Only God has a right to that philosophy. So, my book is an attack on what's often called reductionism, which is the second philosophy. Things are less than they seem. I think they're much more than they seem. Now, the most prominent form of reductionism in modern science is materialism. Materialism is not a scientific theory, it's a philosophical theory. It says that everything exists is made of matter. Matter is all that is. If X is real, X must be material. And that includes thought, spirit, will, love, anything. That's the main example of reductionism today. So, in order to go any further, I want to refute materialism. Here are a couple of very simple arguments against materialism. One of them comes from science. There's a science that studies brains, which are material organs in material bodies. A couple of sciences: anatomy, physiology, cybernetics, and brains. Themselves comes the refutation of the reduction of psychology to physics. Here's the second argument, very concrete one. When you die, your brain is still physically present and intact. You don't lose any molecules until it starts to decay. In fact, on a number of different occasions, people were put on beds, and the beds were put on scales, and they died in those beds, and the scales registered how much was lost at the moment of death. This has been done a couple of times. Some of them have been exposed as fakes, but the two or three experiments which have been verified have come up with the same answer: zero. You're structurally intact at the moment of death. You're just not functioning. The weight of a dead body a second after death is the same as the weight of a live body a second before death. What does that prove? Well, something has disappeared. Something very important, something that activated and enlivened the brain and the body. People used to call that the soul. Most scientists say they don't believe in the soul. Well, then they don't know the difference between life and death. That's pretty dumb. Well, they have an argument. They say, we can't find the soul anywhere. Where is it? Doesn't appear in test tubes, doesn't appear on computer screens. No, it doesn't. Neither do you. When you're working at the computer, you don't appear on the screen. At best, a picture of you can, but that's not you. You're calling up the picture, you're looking at the picture, you're not just the picture. So to say that there is no such thing as a soul is like saying there's no person sitting at the keyboard of a computer because that person never appears on the screen. You see, the soul is the unimaginable subject that's doing the act of imagining. You can't imagine a soul any more than you can see it, because imagining is just a kind of inner seeing. You can't imagine a soul because the soul is the agent, the subject that's doing the imagining. The act by which you imagine something is not itself imaginable. It has no size, shape, weight, etc. You may have a concept of the soul, but you can't have an image. The fact that you can have a perfectly clear and distinct concept of the soul or spirit or of God, but it's impossible to have an imaginative picture of it. The fact that you can conceive what you can't imagine is at least a powerful indication, if not a proof, that you have a power that's not just a material power. You can see the difference between a three-sided figure and a four-sided figure, a triangle and a square. And when you close your eyes, you can also imagine the difference between a three-sided and a four-sided figure. But you cannot see or notice the difference between a 203-sided figure and a 204-sided figure. They both look like circles. And therefore, you cannot imagine that difference. But you can conceive it. You can have a perfectly good concept of it. You can even measure exactly the angle, namely 360 divided by 203 or 204. So concepts can go way beyond images. Images are, or at least the objects of images, are physical, but not the objects of concepts. The materialist scientist will reply, yes, but we have explained everything that you think is spiritual by something physical. Here's the argument for materialism. Draw two columns on the board. Let's call them the material column and the spiritual. Well, says the scientist, yes, they are, because I can explain every single one of them in terms of brain chemistry. This is what happens when you calculate that two and two are four. These electrical charges are running along this part of a computer brain. And this is even what happens when you're having a mystical experience. These parts of the brains are functioning differently. And you cannot point to a single event in the so-called spiritual column, which I cannot explain by a material event in the material column. And that's true. Therefore, there is no such thing as the spiritual column. Well, that doesn't logically follow. From the data that there's a perfect correspondence, always, between spiritual events and physical events, from that premise, it does not follow that one half of the data is unreal. Why choose the material half that's unreal? You could have exactly the same argument for spiritualism, for a kind of Buddhism or Hinduism that says that matter doesn't exist, it's just a thought. Because every bit of matter you can point to, by the act of pointing to it, is in your thought. And therefore, you can dispense with the entire material column, just as well as you can dispense with the entire spiritual column. The scientist defends his reductionism, his dispensing with one column, the spiritual, by a principle called Occam's razor, which is a good practical scientific principle. It says, always use the simplest possible hypothesis. If there are two explanations, both of which explain the data, which one do you prefer, the simpler one? That's a decent practical principle. It doesn't mean that there is no more complex reality. If you're operating on somebody's brain, you don't think about the soul. If you want to explain the rise of Nazism in Germany, you don't talk about demons or divine providence. That doesn't mean there is no soul, or there is no demon, or there is no divine providence. It's just a practical principle. And the very same principle, Occam's razor, can be used to eliminate the physical as well as the spiritual. Finally, the simplest argument, I think, against scientific materialism is that it refutes itself. Scientific materialism argues that anything other than matter doesn't fit into the scientific method. There is no scientific method for verifying the existence of souls, minds, or spirits. And that's true. There's also no scientific argument for the existence of God. This is why, by the way, I'm a little suspicious of the intelligent design movement. I think it's good philosophy, but it's not good science. I think philosophy can prove the existence of some sort of God. I don't think science can. Science has to confine itself to the material world. And design is not a scientifically quantifiable concept. The self-contradiction of scientism, which says that everything certain can be proved by the scientific method. Scientific method is the only reliable method for finding the truth. That's self-contradictory, because that principle itself cannot be proved by the scientific method. So it eliminates itself. Okay, if we've passed reductionism, if we're overcoming that objection to what we're doing, let's go in the opposite direction. Let's use the Hamlet principle. Let's say there are more, not fewer, things than appear. In that case, how do you see them? You see material things with the external eyes, the eyes of the body. And it's kind of traditional language to call these eyes the first eye. The mind is the second eye, the inner eye. Not just the brain, the mind that uses it. There's also a third eye. What's the third eye? Almost every ancient culture knows about the third eye and is expert in third eye thinking. What's that mean? What is the third eye? Well, sometimes it's called the eye of the heart or the eye of the spirit. It doesn't just look at something, whether physical or mental. It looks along it. C.S. Lewis has a wonderful little essay called Meditation in a Tool Shed. And the point of it is distinguishing two kinds of thinking. He locks himself in a tool shed one day and can't get out and looks at the little crack of light in the door and notices how narrow it is and how much darkness surrounds it. And that's looking at it. And then he looks along the crack and he sees a patch of grass and some people and animals hundreds of feet away, and says, my goodness, I use the same eye here, but I'm using two different kinds of thinking. I'm thinking at something, and I'm thinking along it. I had two dogs. One was a smart one, and one was a dumb one. I loved them both, but the Basset Hound was dumb, and the Yellow Lab was smart. And when I would point at their food, the Yellow Lab followed my pointing and went to the food. The Basset Hound came and sniffed my finger. Well, that's the difference between looking along and looking at. The Basset Hound didn't have a third eye. He couldn't interpret things. He couldn't read the signs. I once lost a student's term paper because my dog chewed it up. He chewed up half of it and peed on the other half. So I made the mistake of returning the term paper to the student, the path that the dog peed on, saying, this is my dog's opinion of your term paper, not mine. And the student didn't appreciate the humor. But you see, a dog can't interpret words. A dog can't look along words, can just look at words. Even a baby looks at a book and tries to chew it. That's how we look at the world. We don't interpret it anymore. We don't look at it as a sign, as an omen. Why? Because the third eye isn't open. What is this third eye? Well, it has something to do with the unconscious. Freudian slips, for instance, are done by the third eye. But it has a lot to do with sports. When the third eye clicks in, you become surprisingly successful. Let me give you an example. I once won a bowling tournament, even though I'm not a very good bowler. Our team got into the finals, and the anchor man on the other team was terrific. He had an average 100 points higher than ours, and I knew we had no chance against him. So before we bowled, I said to him, you have the most perfect form I've ever seen. I'd read six books on bowling form, and not a one of them ever told me what a left-hand bowler does with his right hand when he releases the ball. What do you do? He said, I don't know, I never thought about it. He said, okay, I'll look. Well, you know the rest of the story. He was so confused that he, you know, got in his own way. His intuitive, spontaneous, kinesthetic wisdom was interfered with by his second eye thinking, his rational thinking. He was looking at himself instead of looking along himself. The Orient specializes in third eye thinking. The arts, archery, for instance, or painting. There's a famous story of a Chinese landscape painter who was reputed to have the ability to paint anything so real that it came alive, so that if anybody saw his paintings, they wouldn't know the difference between a painting and the reality. The emperor thought he was a fake, so he brought him into the throne room and said, "I want bamboo in my throne room so real that anyone who comes in here will try to pluck it, will try to touch it. And if you don't do that, you'll be executed. You have exactly 1 year." So the man went out into the bamboo fields and lived among the bamboo shoots for 364 days. Then finally, the last day, he came into the king's palace with his brush and his ink and his rice paper. And he spent 23 hours meditating. Then the third hour, he took up his brush and felt it and felt the paper. And he did this for 59 minutes, and he had 60 seconds left. And then in those 60 seconds, he quickly painted bamboo in a few strokes, and it was so real that everyone who came into the throne room tried to pick it. That's third eye thinking. It happens. Most ancient cultures are good at it. We're not. We love control. We control ourselves, we control our lives, we control our world, we control our society. We're very good at that. But third eye thinking is losing control, abandoning control. They did some brain work on people who had mystical experiences in the act of having mystical experiences. They did this for both Western people and Eastern people at the same time. And they expected to find a certain area of the brain that was more active during mystical experience. They found the opposite. They found the area of the brain that does control mystical experience, but in the mystical experience, it doesn't light up. It stops lighting up. It just stops getting in its own way. That's why these experiences aren't checkable scientifically. They give you powers, amazing powers, but the powers are uncontrollable. You're not in control of them anymore, and therefore you can't replicate them, which you have to do to make a scientific experiment. Science can only deal with things that can be repeated. But in these mystical experiences, there's all sorts of data compiled by many perfectly legitimate scientific institutions. For instance, Dr. Rhine's ESP institution at Duke, which has been around for 50 years, another one at the University of Connecticut. There's an American Society for Psychical Research and another one in the UK, all of which are very respectable and tough and scientific, and they've gathered immense data about this, about paranormal data, not just claims, like seeing things 1,000 miles away and reading other minds. In fact, when I was in college, roommate across the hall in the dormitory claimed to be able to read minds. I thought he was a fake. So I tested him. And without telling anybody about it, so he could prepare anything beforehand, I said, "Come into my dorm room." This was like 12 o'clock at night. I shut all the lights and turned on a fan so he couldn't get signals from anybody else. I didn't tell anybody else I was doing this. And I said, "I'm going to do Dr. Rhine's experiment with you. I have 5 cards here. There's a square and a circle and a dot and a moon and a star. And I'm going to sit on this side of the room and I'm going to concentrate on one of those 5 cards. And you're going to sit on the other side of the room in the dark and read my mind." He said, "Fine, I'll do it." He got 20 out of 21 cards. I kid you not. This happens. But these powers are less important than people think. That's what people who have them always say. It isn't the powers, but the wisdom that it brings that's valuable, what it tells us about the universe. As a surfer, I experience this power the most when I'm on a wave or rather when I'm waiting for a wave. I know when a wave is coming. Now, maybe there's some subconscious physical clues, but I can sense a wave coming before it comes. And I can sense just the time to get on it. That's third eye thinking. There's no method for doing that. You can't turn that on. You can only turn off the other eyes. It's like waiting for the evening to turn off the sun so you can see the stars. If you try to turn it on, if you try to find it, your third eye, as an object, you won't be able to do it. Because the consciousness that you use when you try to find something is rational consciousness and practical consciousness. It's a different kind of consciousness. Concepts and desires work very well for ordinary dealing with the world, but those are the two things that have to stop for the third eye to click in. That's why it can't be replicated and experimented on. The ancient worldview in almost all cultures knew this third eye and saw the universe through this third eye and saw that there was much more than appears, that what appears is like the epidermis, and there's a lot beneath the epidermis, or like the surf. The surf is just the surface, the surf face. The sea is much more than the surf. And when you're touched by a wave, you're really touched by the whole sea. The whole ocean is waving at you. It's like when I touch you, it's not just my epidermis that touches you. Suppose I slap you in the face. It's not just my hand that's slapping you in the face. Or suppose I kiss you. It's not just my lips that kiss you. It's me. Well, that's what happens to us whenever we're in contact with the world. It's the whole world, everything from the Big Bang onward, that touches us whenever we're touched by anything. The fact that that sounds flaky to us, that kind of holistic thinking, sounds like New Age nonsense to us, is an index of how far we've come from that old philosophy, which is not New Age flakiness, but quite wise and I think discriminating. There's even an analogy for this in the sciences. When the Curies discovered radioactivity, they did so by looking at this element that they called radium that seemed to have a property that nothing else had. They were fooling around with this gooey stuff called pitchblende, and they noticed that it threw off some sort of energy waves that couldn't be reduced to or explained by any other kind. And they didn't say, oh, that's just this one element. It's an anomaly. They assumed the opposite, that this was just the protuberance, the visible extension of something universal. And they just thus discovered a fundamental force in the universe. Well, let's apply that not just to physical forces, let's apply that to historical forces. You find something that seems like an anomaly, a monster like Adolf Hitler. You say, oh, thank God I'm not like him. Really? Remember the Pharisee and the publican, Jesus' parable? A German philosopher with a French name named Max Picard wrote a book in 1945, just when the war ended, entitled The Hitler in Ourselves. Or take the opposite extreme, Mother Teresa, she's an anomaly, right? No, there's not a single person in this room who cannot be the next Mother Teresa. There's no reason that you can't be a saint. You can, you just don't want to be. Those possibilities are universal in human nature. And anything that you see in the universe tells you something about the entire universe. Like every cell in your body tells you about the whole body, and you can clone an entire body from a single cell. The universe is like that. Therefore, it's one, and it's like a tapestry. The whole is more than the sum of the parts. You can't assemble it by assembling a number of parts. Any work of art is like that. There's a famous parable by a 19th century French philosopher named Henri Bergson. He tells this story of a hive of bees that was expert in mathematics. They thought they were brilliant, and they could explain everything in the universe. So an artist came to him and said, "You can't explain art." The bee says, "Yes, we can. Give us something, and we'll explain it." So the artist brought a beautiful picture, a painting, to the bees. The bees buzzed around the painting for hours and said, "We've got everything in the painting. Every single spot of color, every weight, every permutation and combination and relationship between the spots of color. We put it all in a formula, and here's the formula." And they buzzed the formula. It took them 2 hours, but there was the formula. And it would have taken 1,000 pages in a book. And the artist laughed. And the bee said, "Why do you laugh?" He said, you haven't succeeded in explaining it." "Well, what have we forgotten? Did we forget a dot of color? Did we make a mistake in our calculations?" "No." "Well, if we didn't forget any part, what did we forget?" And the artist said, "You forgot everything." And of course they did. Good example of reductionism. In a beautiful novel called The Bridge of San Luis Rey by Thornton Wilder, Thornton Wilder, by the way, wrote the most popular play in the history of the world, at least in modern times. Our Town is so popular that it is produced in some theater somewhere in the world every single day of the year. Beautiful play. Great writer. Anyway, this little novel called The Bridge of San Luis Rey takes place a few centuries ago in Peru. There's a Franciscan priest, Brother Juniper, who's a scientist, and he's losing his faith because apparently science can explain everything without God. And he's got the problem of evil to confront. And one day he sees in the newspaper a tragedy happens. 5 young people were plunged to their untimely deaths when a rope bridge across the gorge of San Luis Rey broke. So Father Juniper prays and says, "God, this is the last straw. I don't need proofs, but I need clues, and I don't have clues. So I can't believe that you're in charge of this world. Such terrible things happen in it. But I'll give you a chance. If you give me enough reason to believe, if you give me enough clues, I'll come back to the faith." But he leaves his little church, and he spends the next year or so researching these 5 lives, interviewing families, reading diaries, looking at pictures, to try to find some rhyme or reason, some purpose in these lives and why they intersected in such a strange way. And at the end of the investigation, he says, "Okay, God, you've given me enough. You haven't given me clues, but you've given me proof. You've showed me the strings on the back side of your tapestry. And I don't see the front side. I don't see the beauty of the picture. But I see enough design, enough order, enough clues, enough hints on the backside to be able to believe in the front side." That's a beautiful image of what we see in this world. He concludes with the famous line, "Some people say that to the gods we are like flies swatted idly by boys on a summer's day. Others say that not a single hair ever falls from our head to the ground without the will of the Heavenly Father. It's got to be one or the other." If the universe is God's tapestry, then everything in it is related to everything else in it. And the whole explains the part. And therefore, it's only the human mind that abstracts and separates one part from another and just looks at one thing at a time. But one thing doesn't happen at a time. Everything happens simultaneously. We just see it once at a time. There are some spectacular confirmations of this holistic view of the universe in modern science. For instance, what's called Bell's theorem. It's also sometimes called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Don't ask me why. But experiments have proved this. Take 2 particles that have always been together in a 2-particle system. Now separate them violently and send them into opposite ends of the world, or even opposite ends of the universe in outer space. No physical connection between them anymore. No physical force moving between one particle and another. Now, change the state of one of those particles. For instance, zap it. Instantly, you'll see the exact equivalence of a change happening in the other particle, without any discernible or even theoretically knowable physical cause moving between the 2 particles. as if the two are having mental telepathy with each other. The two particles have to be treated as one indivisible whole, like a Catholic marriage. They can't get divorced, ever. Einstein called that, what's the German word? Spukhafte Fernwirkungen, which means spooky action at a distance. Another example. In 1954, the monkeys on Koshima Island, off the coast of southern Japan, started to eat potatoes in a totally different way. 4 years later, all the monkeys in Japan started doing the same thing, even though the island was totally isolated and there was not any connection between the Koshima monkeys and the mainland monkeys. And there was no common cause in the environment that would allow for that. Einstein, however, was not that surprised by it. He believed in what he called the field theory of matter. One of the ways in which Einstein differed from Newton, there were many, was that Newton thought of a material body as enclosed in its surface boundaries. Einstein thought of a material body as existing outside of its surface boundaries as well as inside, in a field. It exists wherever it exerts an effect. Well, if a field, think of an energy field, is the fundamental reality, then everything in that field is going to be affected by everything else in that field, even though we don't see how. Love, for instance. Are there love fields? Of course there are. If I love you, does that make an effect on you, even if you don't know it? Of course it does. It's a kind of gravity. Everybody can see the connection between love and gravity. Love is spiritual gravity. Gravity is a kind of incarnate love. Gravity is love between the particles. Why is it that every particle of matter in the universe is in love with every other particle of matter in the universe? What's the aim of love? Unity. If you love somebody, you want to be with them, both physically and mentally. You want to get inside them as close as you can. That's how matter is. Dante knew that. Dante was a good scientist. Here's the greatest line from the greatest poem from the greatest poet in the world, the last line of the Divine Comedy. The love that moves the sun and all the other stars. That's the summit of human knowledge. That's gravity, says the scientist. Yes, that's right. It's also love. Why does it happen? Nobody knows. We know exactly how. We can specify it mathematically. It's a product of two variables. The mass and inversely the distance. But we can only measure how it works. We don't know why it works. Maybe human love is like radium, a radium point for the theory of everything. Maybe we're not anomalies. Maybe we're not exceptions. Maybe we're the key to the universe. Maybe this distinction between mind and matter and between the subjective and the objective is not absolute. If everything touches everything, deep down, I think the third eye is still active in us enough that we know that, we sense that, we suspect that. That's why the old fairy tales work. Chesterton says in a beautiful book called The Everlasting Man, the book that more than any other one book converted C.S. Lewis, it's about the difference Christ made to history. He says in the chapter on man and mythologies, suppose somebody in a story says, if you pluck this flower, a princess will die in a castle beyond the sea. We do not know why something stirs in our subconsciousness or why what is impossible seems almost inevitable. Suppose we read, and in the hour when the king extinguished the candle, his ships were wrecked far away on the coast of the Hebrides. We do not know why our imagination has accepted that image before our reason can reject it. Some dim suggestion that the things nearest to us stretch far beyond our power, some sacramental feeling of the magic in material substances. Magic. We don't believe in magic anymore. Well, primitive forms of magic are just that, primitive guesses. But behind every error, there's usually a half-truth. And in rejecting the error, don't throw out the half-truth. The ancient Greeks thought that the entire universe was a musical instrument. And the heavenly bodies, which they knew were round, were spheres. By the way, nobody thought the earth was flat, except people who don't know much about history. They thought that the universe was the music of the spheres. This is from Pythagoras, probably the first great scientist in history. He thought the planets made perfect music. He measured the mathematical proportions of a stringed instrument and calculated the distance of the five visible planets to the Earth and found it was the same mathematical formula, the same proportion. He concluded that the planets were making music. And the only reason we didn't hear the music, he said, is that because we're part of it. We're in it. We're notes in the music. When the greatest of philosophers, Plato, wrote the most famous of philosophy books, The Republic, he spent a whole book on music. He spent more time on music than on politics. He spent one paragraph on economics, but 40 pages on music. There was an old wise man called Damon of Athens who said, "Let me write the songs of a nation, and I care not who writes its laws." See, music is an image of wholeness. The Republic, as you probably know, is about justice, but not just in the state, also in the soul, and also in the cosmos, and also in music. It's the very same concept. The Greeks used the same word, dike, or dikaiosune, for all four of those things. Souls, states, nature, and music. A kind of universal cosmic harmony, or right order. So, if we ever do find the theory of everything, it's going to solve some problems in politics, too. That's what the ancient Chinese thought. Both the Taoists and the Confucians, two very different schools of thought in ancient China, thought that the key to understanding politics was music, a kind of cosmic harmony. Confucius once couldn't speak for 2 days. He was so moved by a musical melody. The Greeks, the ancient Greeks, even after they stopped believing in the gods, believed in nine. For a long, long time, the nine muses. They couldn't believe that music was a mere human invention. They were so deeply moved by music that they thought, this, above all, proves the existence of God. But Greek music was very, very simple. No symphony orchestras, no polyphony either, even. The third eye was open. Confucianism was the most successful social and political system in the history of the world. It held together China for 2,000 years till Mao Zedong destroyed it, or tried to. And China was the largest country in the world. How did it work? Well, by this notion of harmony. There's a story of a Confucian emperor. Nobody knows whether this is historically true or not, but it's often repeated in Chinese history texts. An ancient Confucian emperor held together China by music. There were a lot of threats of civil war and rebellion, and he had to rule the world's greatest empire, and he didn't have that many soldiers or that much money. So he disguised himself as a peasant and wandered through his largest cities each year, listening to the music that people sang and played. And if the music was in harmony with the cosmic music, he would not send soldiers. But if it was in disharmony, he would. And it worked. The soldiers happened to be on the scene just as rebellions broke out. The cosmic music is, of course, God's music, because he's the inventor of the cosmos. Christians believe that the cosmic music became incarnate in Christ. Christ, therefore, is the key to everything, not just to religion. The word religion, by the way, is an unfortunate word, because the early Christians didn't call Christianity a religion. They called it the way. Like the Chinese word Tao, Bibles translated into Chinese have John's gospel begin this way. In the beginning was the Tao, and the Tao was with God, and the Tao was God. If you want one religious book that sounds more like the New Testament than any other, read the Tao Te Ching and look for the dozens of parallels between that and the Sermon on the Mount. One of the most profoundly religious and mystical composers of all time was Sibelius. And he wrote that his music was brought to life by the Logos, the cosmic Christ. He described his Fifth Symphony in these words. He said, "It is as if God the Father threw down pieces of mosaic from heaven's floor and asked me to solve how the picture looked." The cultural consequences of restoring this view of the cosmos in Western civilization, I think, are going to be immensely practical. This may sound like something very flaky. I think it's just the opposite. I think it's deeply healing. Our society glorifies disorder. Let's take three places where it glorifies disorder. Music, sex, and drugs. Obviously, the sexual revolution is disorderly, destroys the family, destroys stability. Obviously, drugs scramble your mind. But music, quintessentially hypermodern music, is a definite attack, a deliberate attack on order. Schoenberg is the archetypal figure here. Schoenberg is a very religious man. He's an atheist. And he said, God is dead, therefore the Logos is dead, therefore harmony is dead, therefore tonality is dead. He forbade tonality. His basic slogan for musical creativity was, nothing constrains me. That's the philosophy of Satan. His disciple, John Cage, who wrote symphonies made of vacuum cleaners and other sounds, forbade any harmony. They hated real music because it was real. Like Karl Marx. Karl Marx wrote, everything that exists deserves to perish. That's one of the most frightening sentences I've ever read. It's the death wish. That's the cultivation of chaos. And music is an anti-chaos. It, without denying disharmony, produces harmony out of it. Without denying plurality, sees the unity in it. Well, our society, any society, that cultivates chaos dies. When a body cultivates chaos, it dies. There are only two possible ways to hold together any body, a body politic, a human body, externally or internally. A society is an organism, and it defeats chaos and death either by external cops or internal cops. And if it doesn't have the internal cops, if it doesn't have conscience, it will repent of its disorder and survive, or else it will descend into it and die. Now, there are many forms of order. Music is one of them. But I want to suggest what's going to sound very flaky to you and rather strange as another very powerful healing mechanism for all three of these disorderly revolutions in our society. It's surfing. I kid you not. First of all, the drug revolution. There's no drug that's higher than the high you get on a wave. Secondly, music. There's nothing more perfect music than a wave. And finally, there's nothing more sexy than a wave. The New York Times, this is a New Yorker magazine, some years ago, did a poll of a cross-section of 200 surfers. And they asked the question, if you had to give up either sex or surfing for the rest of your life, which would you give up? 89% of them said they'd give up sex. 11% said they'd give up surfing. They got a plethora of hundreds of letters from surfers all over the world after that story ran, denouncing the story as a fake. And all the letters said basically the same thing. You couldn't possibly find 11% of surfers who'd give up surfing. It's a fake. When you're inside a wave, it's called the green room or the green cathedral. Even atheists become believers at that point. They say, God's in the tube. It's a mystical experience. It's very much like the classical near-death experience or out-of-the-body experience. You're plunged into this dark tunnel. You're drawn towards a light at the far end of it, like the birth canal. Time itself changes. Every second lasts forever. There is no time. For God, there is no time. If we could touch that divine consciousness, it wouldn't take us out of time and make us useless in time. It would do exactly the opposite. It would redeem time. Let me give you a very simple example of that from the Gospels. The thief on the cross. He's a thief all his life, probably a murderer. He's destroyed many lives. There's no insurance policies in ancient Israel. So if he thieved from a family and stole their money, they're not going to get their money back, and they're poor for the rest of their lives. Now, imagine that you are one of those families that has been destroyed by this horrible man, this murderer. And you're hanging around Calvary to see that he gets his just reward. And then you hear Jesus say to him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, today you are to be with me in paradise." How do you feel? Resentful, right? Angry, right? And if you could talk to Jesus, you'd say, "Jesus, what about the 50 years of evil? How can they just be forgotten just because of a deathbed repentance?" And what would Jesus say to you? I think he'd say, "Stop living in the past. The past is dead. There is paradise now in the present, in this genuinely repentant thief's heart. And I'm just telling you what is. Live in the present." Very hard to do. Living in the present doesn't mean seize the day and do whatever you want. Living in the present means not fantasizing about the future. The future is the least real kind of time there is. The past at least once existed. The future hasn't existed yet at all. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. What a stupid song. That's the devil's song. Just look at your thoughts. How many of them are actually concerned with the present? Most of the time we're fantasizing about the future, or maybe resenting the past. Don't almost all our problems come from the past or the future? We're bedeviled by bad things in the past, and we're afraid of bad things in the future. Live in the present. That's where God is. That's a good note to end on. And the present thing we want to do now is ask a lot of questions. So I invite your questions.
Okay, so I heard about a study one time where people, middle-aged adults, were given like a very strong hallucinogenic, and a large percentage of them reported having the most spiritual experience of their entire life. Mm-hmm. What do you say to those people? Like, what is your counter-argument to that kind of statistic?
In 1969, when I first came to Boston College, I won a Danforth Fellowship to study Zen Buddhism, so I went to Japan. And I was fascinated with this kind of question, because a lot of interesting writers like Aldous Huxley make the claim that hallucinogenic drugs can ape mystical experience. So I said, well, rather than just asking Westerners who I'm familiar with, I'll go into this other culture. And one of the questions I'll ask all these Zen Buddhist masters that I meet is, what about this claim that hallucinogenic drugs can ape mystical experience? Every single one of them said the same thing. They laughed. They said, that's like making love to a picture. Or they said, that's like thinking you're swimming when you're watching the fish. It apes it. Yeah, it's a picture of it. But it's not the real thing. In fact, that's scientifically demonstrable. They put electroencephalograms on monks having satori, mystical experience, and the same thing on people having LSD experiences. And they found that there was a significant difference. All the LSD experiences were one kind of something or other, and all the mystical experiences were the other kind. So it looks like the same thing, but it isn't. It's a fake.
I'm a trained physicist, but I also took some degrees in history, and I need a clarification of some of your thoughts, if you would. You mentioned this third eye, this searching for the unexplainable, if you will, that special thing that we get by reaching, and you call to mind ancient civilizations, the Confucians, the Greeks. Well, you talk about 2,000 years of Confucius and that religious calmness spreading through. China had some of the most intensive wars throughout that period, Confucians on both sides, as they do in many wars, carried different flags, and therefore they didn't seem to listen to Confucius. Mm-hmm. The Greeks, as they were interested with all their logos and listening to the music of the spheres, were very busy butchering each other mm-hmm. over which city-state was paramount. What is it in those ancient civilizations with their third eye that you so admire, which we would bring here if those are the examples of third eye apparently had something to do with?
Corruptio optimi pessima is an ancient Latin saying. The corruption of the best things is the worst thing. Religion is one of the best things in the world, and religious warfare is one of the worst things in the world. So the fact that in every religion there is violence and there is hypocrisy and there is evil in the name of religion does not invalidate the claims of religion.
True, but then how does the ancient world, because I sensed that you felt they were living a better life, that they had wisdom that we do not have.
I've got to correct myself if I left that impression. If I had the option of taking a time machine and going back and living the rest of my life in ancient Greece or living here, I choose here. So I don't think overall they were better off than we are. But they had one thing that we lack, that third eye. We have much better social systems and laws, much better respect for persons, much more enlightened religion, and above all, we have science and technology. And I think the one thing none of us would want to live without is anesthetics.
Agreed. But then what is the purpose of the search for this third eye if, in fact, our society, as you've explained, has so many advantages over societies which had it? I still don't.
And now comes a surprising answer. There's got to be at least one thing that has no purpose. That is the end rather than a means. And the essence of liberal education is the faith that there is such a thing, and that thing is truth. To know the truth simply for its own sake, rather than using it as a servant or slave of something else, is freeing or liberal. So the reason for the third eye is simply that it tells you the truth, whether it's practical or not.
And I would tell you that as a scientist, and I will disagree with your statement concerning scientists' reflection, we do not believe that we have the answer.
Oh, I know.
As I think you're well aware, science always will parse its findings by saying, with what we know now, this is the best answer.
That's its glory. That's why it progresses.
But that is essentially, therefore, as viable a truth as one which can only come from faith, is it not?
Yes. I was not quarreling with science at all. I was quarreling with the philosophy of materialism, which unfortunately has affected too many scientists. That's a philosophical mistake.
And I would not argue that point.
Good.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your clarifications.
I'd like to start just thank you for your wonderful books. They've had a tremendous impact on my life. Also, the question I had was about, you said mystical experience not being...
Second time, and it didn't work the second time.
With the same person?
The same person.
Oh, wow. Okay. So then I guess the second thing would be, if you think mystical experience like St. Teresa of Avila or Thérèse of Lisieux or even internationally, I mean, you mentioned Aldous Huxley, his book where he... talks about globally, if you are selfless, if you try to spend time with God, then you have these sorts of experiences that lead to change. Or like, for example, Alcoholics Anonymous or 12-step programs. I see people's lives radically changed inside and outside of Christianity who hand themselves over to goodness, to
yep.
truth, and you see people that are filled with joy and peace. Isn't that kind of something testable, observable, and in some sense measurable, would be the question I have.
Its effects are measurable, but the joy, the peace, the transformation itself is not measurable. It's not an empirical or a quantifiable thing. One of the reasons science progressed so much, so quickly in the last 400 years, is it stopped trying to do philosophical and religious stuff. It stopped asking non-quantifiable and non-empirical questions and confined itself to the narrow confines of the scientific method. And like a laser beam, it cut through a lot of stuff that way. But I would also distinguish the universal possibility of having mystical experience inherent in the third eye, which everybody has, from those very special mystical experiences granted by God, by divine grace, to some of his special saints. Those are different. Those are much more high and authentic and direct connections with God. But they're certainly connected, just as, for instance, human reason and divine revelation are connected.
We do not have it today really valid. Like, how can you make that claim?
Well, it is an aspect of our consciousness. So are our bodily senses, that's the first eye. So is our rational left brain thinking, that's our second eye. So this is just another aspect of our consciousness.
But then, I don't know, I mean, I feel like it's hard to say that it doesn't exist today.
Oh, I didn't say it didn't exist. I said it's an untrained muscle. We're not expert in it. We're not trained in it. We don't even talk about it. But it's the third eye that decides things like this. When you go out into your backyard and you're far away from the city and you look out into the vastness of outer space at night, you probably say, how vast the universe is and how empty. Very beautiful, but how enormous it is, how small I am. We use the word space for the universe. The ancients didn't think that way. They thought the opposite way. The word space for every ancient culture was an abstract word. It wasn't a concrete word. It didn't mean the rest of the universe beyond the atmosphere of the earth. It meant the geometrical aspect of material things, how much space is in it. It meant extension. Their word for what we call space was the heavens. It was a positive word. They thought they were looking in. Now, there's no scientific way of determining who's right there. That's not a scientific question. That's not a first eye or second eye question. That's a third eye question. When you look at the heavens, are you looking at God or are you looking at space? One of the ancient Greek myths was that the stars are holes in the sky. And through those holes, you see the fires of the gods. That's not how we feel. We don't hear the music of the spheres. We hear silence. So that's a radical change. Our whole relationship to the universe is inside out.
I suppose so. I feel like there may be more avenues now than there were then.
That's true. Modern science is coming back to a much more holistic view.
Right. And so I feel like while the reductionist view can get away from a lot of, from the positive holistic, the positive aspects of, holisticism, I don't know. But I feel that it's not really negative, the whole impact of modern science and what has...
Oh, I didn't mean to leave that impression at all. In fact, one of the greatest of modern scientists, Niels Bohr, once said... In a conversation with Mortimer Adler, the Thomist philosopher, after Adler explained to him Thomas's philosophy of angels and how they immediately influenced each other beyond time and space, he says, that man, it was a 13th century Dominican monk, you say? Yes. Well, he just invented one of the basic points of quantum theory. Because that is what happens on a quantum level when, for instance, an electron moves from one orbit to another. It never is found anywhere between the two orbits, and there's no time differential between the time it leaves the first place and the time it gets to the second place. That's how angels work. So, yeah, modern science is wonderfully opening up the universe, and we're miles beyond the science of the famous atheists who are back in Newtonian mechanics.
Thank you for your time.
Basically, I've got two things. One, I'd just like to personally, publicly thank you for your lifetime of work.
It's not over yet.
No, it's not.
I'm old, but I'm not that old.
Now, up to this point, because of you, my life, and I suspect many other people in the room, and certainly in the country and the world, their lives are richer, more intellectually fulfilling, and certainly a lot more fun. In particular, my understanding and pleasure from Lewis and Tolkien would not be anywhere near where it is were it not for you. Not to mention your introducing me to Aquinas and Augustine.
So go pass it on.
And so anyway, thanks. All that, the importance of that really is that it's brought me and many other people closer to Christ, and it's enabled them to explain Jesus and the faith to young people. And that takes me to my question, which, since you mentioned the reputation of materialism, and sort of mentioned Lewis, I want to teach a class to some of my young Sunday school students on the book Miracles, and I can't figure out how to explain the terms ground and consequent.
A 12-page set of notes on the book Miracles, which was compiled by Father Joseph Fessio, who teaches a 2-month course on that book. It's very clarifying. That's a masterpiece, that little book.
Thank you very much.
By the way, if any of you have not read everything that C.S. Lewis has written, go out immediately and buy it.
Thank you again, Doctor, for your lecture. Recently, one of my friends and I were talking about perspectives of success and satisfaction, and he basically divided them into present hedonistic success, present-oriented, and then future-oriented. And in that present-oriented is really focused on the now, and you just were talking about living in the present. And future-oriented usually puts success and satisfaction and the values of that in discipline and what comes from the future of hard work. In reference to what you were talking about with the third eye and sort of, I guess, mystic experiences, how would you say that you're able to find the balance between these two with your idea that we need to always be open to our third eye? Like, how do those, I guess, fit in?
I think third eye thinking is something like an eternal perspective. It not only integrates past, present, and future, but it perceives timeless truths. It perceives the logos. The word that formed the universe. It's a kind of a terribly distant, terribly inadequate glimpse of the mind of God. Yeah. It's like that little kid on the beach touching the wave.
Yeah, so would you say that while it may be experience-oriented and that we need to be open to that, that the importance of having discipline and the importance of still putting a lot of your prospects in the internal perspective is still important?
Certainly, because one of the characteristics of living in the present is accepting your responsibilities. Responsibilities are always present things that you presently accept or reject, and those include responsibilities for the future.
Thank you, Doctor.
I have a sweet friend whose father, on his deathbed, was convinced that Jesus was a Catholic and couldn't imagine the Jewishness of Jesus, and she tried to convince him of that.
Mary wasn't saying the rosary when the angel appeared to her.
Exactly. I would like for you to speak to how, as the Way moved from a Jewish movement into the Greek world, how, because Jewish culture being more of an Eastern thought culture, how that influenced or how that took us away from that intuitive third eye sort of way of understanding God and the world.
Well, I disagree with only one thing that you say. This is what happened, but I don't think this took us away. I think it took us towards. I think it was divinely providential. When St. Paul had the Macedonian vision, he was going to bring the gospel east. Instead, he went to Greece. That was not an accident. That was from the Holy Spirit. Now, that doesn't mean that Western civilization is in all ways superior to Eastern civilization. It might mean the opposite. Christianity goes into the ghettos, where the need is the greatest. But the Hellenization of Christianity was not an accident. It's not the last word, but it's a positive development. That doesn't mean there can't be further levels. Because Christ is, well, all truth is in Christ. He's not just a local deity. He's the mind of God that ordered the universe. Therefore, whatever is good or true or beautiful in every culture is part of Christianity.
Sure. I wouldn't argue that that it wasn't.
But you are profoundly right in suggesting that we have disastrously forgotten Jesus' Jewishness. And if you look at the history of heresies in the church for the last 2,000 years, almost every one of them has forgotten Jesus' Jewish roots. That's extremely important.
Dr. Grave, thank you for coming out. I came and saw you 5 years ago when you were in town. Thanks for coming back. I was wondering how important you think it would be, not would be, but it is to understand, or at least have the illustration of Aristotle's four causes in explaining a lot of differences between, you know, the supposed debate with religion and science.
Crucial. No one is educated unless they understand the four causes. This is one of the most useful ideas in the history of human thought. It classifies all possible questions and all possible answers into four commonsensical categories. And one useful way of defining the reductionism that I spoke against would be reducing final causes to efficient causes and formal causes to material causes. Saying that there is no such thing as a holistic form, it's only the material parts out of which the form comes, and there is no such thing as an objectively real end or meaning or purpose. There is only the motives and the pushes inside and outside that push us and the universe around. There's all four.
Thank you.
Thank you for your lecture. It seems to me that in the Christian church today that we do have some ways that people are endeavoring to develop third eye kind of consciousness, and that being centering prayer, the Thomas Keating movement, and the World Community of Christian Meditation. And I think of yoga as being another technique coming from the East that has been largely, to some extent, kind of trivialized. But my question for you is, what other practical everyday disciplines do you see as being valuable for working towards this different kind of consciousness?
Let me give you two answers. One is a negative one, which you will probably find a bit shocking, and the other is a positive one. The negative one is that all the great saints minimize techniques. Techniques are not in themselves wrong, but very little comes of them. And ultimately, the more important the thing is, the less important technique is. Technique is terribly important when you're trying to repair your car. To repair a marriage, there's not a manual with technique. To repair your relationship with God, there's not a program where you can push buttons. So technique, although not in itself bad, any more than, let's say, science is bad, is not going to get you there. There's no cause-effect relationship. If you do this, you will become a mystic. No, all the mystics say that's fake. Which is not to say that techniques cannot be useful, but sit light on them. Secondly, what I've found, this is purely personal, and maybe this is just the proclivities of my personality, and I'm not trying to impose that on anybody else, but what I have always found is the simpler, the better. Keep it simple. And one of the simplest and my favorite of the mystics' book is The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. Very simple. Once you realize the blinding truth that God is right here, you suddenly get a clarified consciousness and everything falls into place. And it's very difficult to sin when you're looking God in the face. So just look him in the face all the time.
Sorry, I'm going to have to call a halt to this section of it, although you can get to meet with Dr. Craft at our reception, and you'll get to meet with him a little bit more over there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.